Well, I hope Bart comes in. No, Bert. Hope Bert comes in. I'll get a few minutes of conversation out of him. Do you want to say anything, Sarah? What? Somebody started to say something. Hey, Kyle, Bob. We were listening. Yeah, we were broadcasting you.
You were broadcasting.
Woo! Yeah, you're counting. We did it twice for 10 minutes. Everybody's laughing their heads off at you trying to work out the missing zero and the millions of something, whatever.
Oh, really?
44 points.
Zion said the answer was 16, Kyle.
On the second issue that you were just doing it 2 minutes ago, he says the answer is 16.
It wasn't 24, it was 16.
Yeah, talking about end runs and football players, Wilt Chamberlain, tallest guys on the planet.
Yeah, we calculated that there's been 23,000 people over 7 foot in history.
Now, Kyle, what's wrong with you? We're there talking to Ion, and you're fucking and can't even engage. What's your issue there? Because I put you on mute?
No, I'm at work, and this guy that I'm friends with came in, and I was talking to him. I can't always be by the phone here. I have to get up and leave and come back, get up and leave and come back. So while I'm here, I'm not always here.
But you got him. You got all involved in figuring out the tallest people, how many there were. Why get involved with that?
Well, actually, we were trying to figure out the smartest people. We just tried to relate that to tall people. Okay, we said how many athletes? Only Wilt Chamberlain, Shaquille O'Neal, and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar were athletic enough to play basketball and score a lot of points. So out of 23,000 7-footers and out of 7 billion people, only 3 were athletic enough to be basketball players.
Well, how did you get that number, 23,000? Where do you find that?
He found it on the internet.
The Ken Dave Mutombo, too. Did you say him?
Yeah, but these you have to be prolific, all-pro, Hall of Fame people. Not just 7-footers, but they have to be Hall of Fame and score 25 points a game or for their career. So we were trying to relate that to the intelligence factor. What would you get Sir Isaac Newton, Einstein, Max Planck, some of those people? We were looking at a bell-shaped curve, and it comes out to 0.003%. That's what that number equals, 0.003%. That's 5 standard deviations from the normal. How we got on that subject, I'm not really sure, to tell you the truth. It just happened. He and I are like, we get into those types of conversations. But what I wanted to say, I wanted to get in early to Ion is I found the name of copper sulfide.
Yeah.
It's called
the name of it.
Yeah, the common name of it. It's called Chevreul's salt. Chevreul's salt. So it's a red powder. It's they show you how to make it on YouTube. So it's easily made. They just haven't found out what it's good for.
What do you make of that, Carol? Hey, Karen, what do you make of that? You're not listening?
I'm not listening.
Okay, she's not listening. Talk about Sulfite. copper sulfite.
It's easy to make. I mean, I watched it on YouTube. It's about a 10-minute operation. You mix some.
I got an email from Love Job. He says, pretty cool talk with Ion today. I need to step my game up, but it was fruitful, and I'll have to sit on it. That's Love Job's assessment of his many hours talking to Ion tonight. And on the next Bob show, he suggests, let's have the Renner sisters on. He wants to have the Renner sisters on.
How long did you listen to that to me, Bob?
A long time. We laughed for 10 minutes in two different segments.
Oh God!
Do you listen to all the archives?
I listen to as many as I can. It just depends on how busy I am. I always listen to the ones they post on the website, the Ion and Bob website.
Yeah, well, those you listen to all the Ion on that, right?
Yes, I always listen to those.
Well, you'll hear yourself in the later hours.
That's what I usually do. I try to go back where I think there's quite a few people and there might be some interesting conversation. I just pick out hours and click in and try to see if I stumble across something that's interesting. I just pick and choose. But I do it every week. I try to stay up with you guys. I just can't participate because I work and I get home at midnight and it's winter up here and I just don't have the energy.
Once you start, you have the energy. You don't go in. You don't feel. Go by your feeling. We were actually talked about that earlier tonight. Roxana and energy. Ion does not recognize energy.
Yeah, I heard that.
Yeah.
But I actually pass out. I mean, you know, in the summertime, it's no problem. But we've had three straight weeks of, you know, freezing weather, and I have to be out in it. So when I come in, when I get home and it's warm, I literally just sit down in the chair and pass out.
Yeah.
I wake up, but I'm not in any kind of shape to talk. I can listen, but I can't talk.
Aren't you on the drops?
Yeah.
Well, just take a swig of drops.
Thank you, sir.
But then I need to go to bed for real. I have to go to bed for real to be able to go back to work. I have to work tomorrow and Monday and Tuesday. My days off are Wednesdays and Thursdays.
Right.
So during the summer, I'm okay. It's just this last, I don't know if you know what's going on the East Coast, but it's brutal up here.
Where are you?
I'm right outside of Atlantic City.
Atlantic City, New Jersey, right, okay. So it's brutal, cold for months, right?
No, just three straight weeks of continuous snow and single-digit
right.
Nights.
Many people die in that situation?
In Boston and up in those areas, they got killed.
Because they didn't have the heat?
I don't know what the reason was. Probably, yes.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of homeless people in those cities.
Yeah. Okay, well, we're going to read some Alan Cabal now.
I'm glad y'all enjoyed listening to my insanity.
Well, the good news is Bert's here. Bert's fine Bart. Enough, well enough to speak. Right, Bert?
Yes.
Hey, Bob, before Bert talks, what do you think about that? That is not a common product, but the unique thing about it, it has both forms of copper in it. And what they're saying is that they're looking for ways to use it. They haven't really. It's easy to make, but they haven't. The closest thing they've come up with is they can use it as an insulator on microprocessors.
Well, Carl, that's why you should be. That's why you listen to us. We already are using it in the way it's going to be used, and we'll monopolize it. So,
oh really?
Don't worry about it. Those idiots that are fucking out there looking for shit because they haven't got the guts to talk to Ion. Then they might be able to catch up, but they're not going to. They're going to stay stuck in their world for the next 500 years. But meanwhile, we go forward with the copper sulfide, using it for our own proper purposes.
Okay, great. I'm glad somebody is.
Well, no, you want to say it more than that. You should be. I'm amazed that somebody is. Not, I'm glad somebody is. I'm amazed that somebody, again, it's Ion. You should go, I'm amazed Ion's doing it again.
Yeah, well, okay. I'm amazed that Ion's doing it.
Do I have to fucking force you to be amazed? Come on, man. Get fucking awake. You're here in the middle of the second coming in every other superlative fucking condition you could be. You're here, and you're busy counting up dead people and how tall they were. You know, this is a silly child.
But I'm at work. You know, I have to deal with Pete. That guy works with me. And so I have to talk to him on his level. I didn't know I was...
No, you bring him up to your level. You tell him, hey, buddy, I'm listening to this. Tell him to listen to it.
I've tried to. I've talked to him about it. He would have got up and run out if I said that.
Well, that's good. That's good. Then you can listen to us. Not have to fucking make up statistics with him.
True, but he's a good computer guy, and he works on my computer when I have problems, so I got to stay on his good side.
Okay, you can't argue for your limitations there, Kyle.
No, you
killed off the 41-year-old black sex pot, now you're going to kill this fucking guy off. Well, I'm glad you have a good sense of humor about it.
Yeah, I'm glad y'all got a laugh out of it.
Yeah. Yeah, Bert, we would just click on his line there whenever we want to, and Bert's arguing with the other. I mean, Kyle's arguing with the other guy, but whether it's 5 million or 7 million, or Bert's missing zero.
I was listening to him, Bob. I didn't call him, but I heard that it was funny, Kyle. You should listen to it.
Yeah, Kyle. Okay. You want to hear what Ion did about, you know, right at the end. He did a whole commentary. It might be hard to hear, but he made commentary on what you were saying for about 5 minutes. He was just talking about tight ends and all this football talk.
No, it was basketball players.
I don't remember. It was basketball.
Yeah.
Well, Bert, could you make out what Ion was mumbling to what Kyle was saying?
Well, sometimes he was mentioning zeros and numbers, and he was making recommendations on numbers when Kyle was doing his 10 billion or a couple billion.
No, that was earlier. The last topic about.
No, I
didn't. You didn't hear. He's talking about, statistics of sports, I guess, basketball.
And, well, he did say something about Wilt Chamberlain.
Yes, but I was totally on top of the jargon, Kyle. He knew how to talk. The way you were talking, he was doing it. You'll hear it.
Okay.
Thanks for providing content, Kyle. We have to scrape the barrel off and, you know, look for something to entertain our listeners around the world. So, Bert,
can you apply that to the drops in any way?
No, just keep taking the drops. Don't think about
it. Okay.
Don't add up shit when you're dealing with the drops.
Okay.
I think we were joking. So, okay, if I take 5 million drops per day for 3 years, what does that lead to?
Oh, man.
So, Bert, I know you must have you got sick on purpose so you could spend a lot of time doing homework, right?
Yes. Well, not on purpose. I have like a 1 week window in February, March where my body shuts down and I catch some. I mean, I kind of like recleans itself, so I got a little sick.
But that always happens regularly.
Well, actually, this is the first year it actually came down, because since I started the RNA drops, I never, you know, caught anything around that time, because that's always my window. But this year it snuck up on me, so.
Well, was it because of the shock of the new information you're absorbing?
Probably. Probably. It's really been a shift. Every time I do my homework, it really changes everything.
Yes.
But I do have a lot of little things to talk to you about, Bob.
Well, we'll do that. We'll do that privately.
Okay. No, but
I can call you. I'll call you sometime.
Okay. But I'm talking about Walter Borard and Don Thiel and DeKirchhoff.
Oh, we can talk about them in public. Yeah. Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Let's go.
Damn. Where do I start? I was like I said before, I always like going into your timeline and just like dowsing, you know, things that see a name and just plug in. So I went to September 1990 and saw probably one of the funniest, everything is funny what you do, but a funny.
The footage with Walter.
Yes. And my question, when did you meet Walter Borard? Because he really was very familiar with you and was congratulating you and saying how proud he was of you.
Yeah, Walter was a great guy. I first heard of Walter Borard in 1968. I subscribed to Avant-Garde magazine, which was a hip magazine. I think it was coming out of New York. I think it was started by the guy who started Evergreen Review. Or he did pornography or something in the 50s, you know, one of these early freedom of speech guys. Forget his name now. We could probably look it up on the wiki. So he started an art magazine called Avant-Garde. And in about the second issue, and I have it right out in the garage. I still have my copies, 22 issues. There was an article on Walter Borard and the East Village Other. Now, I don't know if I knew of the East Village Other at that moment. But I subscribed to it right away. And either I was getting it because I found out about some other way, there was an article on Walter Borard because the East Village Other was where it was happening and Borard was an interesting guy, so they did an article on him. So it either triggered me to subscribe to it or an article on him came out right when I was reading the paper. So he disappeared from the masthead of the East Village Other by 69. I remember he wrote, early 68, right when I was starting to get the magazine, the newspaper out of New York City, he dropped off it. He wasn't on it. So the article was celebrating him, but he actually wasn't with the East Village Other anymore. Turned out he had gone, he was on his way, he had hooked up with Peggy Hitchcock, who Tim Leary had made a deal with him. Okay, I'll give you Peggy Hitchcock, and you give me East Village Other. Well, he ended up with Walter ended up with Peggy Hitchcock, and Leary never got the East Village Other. So I don't know what happened there. But Walter sent in an article in the summer of 68. It's sort of the future of America. What it had was a little town, and the town square was no longer just this town square. It had a box. And it was like a Hyde Park where people would go in and rant through a studio or a mega electronical, you know, gadget where you could blast the people, like Alex Jones started off driving around Austin, Texas with a loudspeaker in a car, you know. Well, you'd go to the square and do a rant to the public in this electrified box. So I thought that was pretty McLuhan-esque, so I was impressed with his scenario. And it's all pretty wooden in retrospect, but it was pretty good at the time. Walter saw that the American people would end up very isolated and would just have to express themselves and do it in a box, a so electrified soapbox and broadcast, you know, but to do it to nobody. It's interesting how he saw the communication world becoming solipsistic. So that was Borard. So Borard showed up, did that, and then he disappeared. And I never found out where he was. And I think I've told this story before, and you've listened to everything, so I might come into what you've already heard before. And then 10 years later, McLuhan had a stroke on September 26, 1979. So we were limping along with his son running the Monday night seminars. And on the Monday before December
3rd. I could go look up the calendar and get the exact date, 1979. A group of strangers came in. They handed out pamphlets. Wait a minute. Let's do it this way. So one day in 1978, I'm walking through a mall in Toronto, and in the bookstore it says Operation Mind Control by Walter Borat. I said, holy shit, the guy wrote a book. And, you know, I got a good memory. If someone did, I have a file on someone in my memory, and I'll remember them. Jeez, how the guy showed up. So I read the book, and it was a very good book. And that was that. That's early 78. And that didn't go anywhere. So it didn't lead to anything about Walter, just he did this book. So then it's almost 2 years later, November 1979, this strange people walk into the McLuhan Seminar. And McLuhan is not there, hasn't been there actually since April, because he normally started the 1st of October, but his stroke was September 26th, so he wasn't available. So he started up. So Eric ran it, his son. And these people come in, they hand out leaflets. I look at it, it says, coming to OISE, educational institution in Toronto, Walter Borat will speak on Operation Mind Control. So I got talking to these people, and they were Scientologists, and they were sponsoring Walter's talk, because I found out later they were anti-psychiatry, and Walter seemed to be exposing psychiatry, how the CIA used the most extreme parts of it, of MK Ultra and all that stuff. So I made a point of going the next Sunday, I think it was, Sunday, maybe December 2nd. And so I showed up around noon hour when it was scheduled to talk, and I saw this tall, handsome guy, very tall guy, and I walked up to him, and I said a few words to him, and he said, we should talk after. So whatever I said to him intrigued his attention, so we agreed to meet after. So I watched his slideshow, very good talk on the history of the MKUltra and the CIA, and then after he took all the questions and finished, we met up, and we went for a walk, and we went back to his hotel room and talked all night. And then I spent the next week being with him often, talking. And he told me that when he left the East Village Other, he was looking for Marsh McLuhan's son. He imagined or knew that Marsh McLuhan had a son, and he wanted to do something with him. But he didn't really look hard enough, because Eric McLuhan was in New York City doing the Do Line. So it never happened. So I said, well, you can meet Eric tomorrow. That would be Monday, December 3rd, 1979. So we went to the. I took him to the Monday night thing, and asked Eric if he could speak, if Walter could speak, and he said sure. But Eric wanted to do his thing first on the Wilson Bryan Key subliminal seduction embedments and ads, the subliminals put in there. So Eric did that, and I had announced that we had a guy there. And then after a couple hours, Eric was going on and on. Someone asked him to stop. We got his message. Let's hear from this other guy. So Walter got to speak, and he did his MKUltra, you know, short version of it, and that was that, and turned out that was the last performance in the Cochos of the Monday Night Seminars. Walter closed the show.
Wow.
After being going for, you know, 15 years, and Marshall never recovered. He died a year later, and they closed the Cochos down by the next summer. And that was that. And it just turned out that I brought in Walter to be the last guy, and he was very involved with McLuhan all his life since the mid-60s. Always thought about McLuhan, tried to apply what he thought McLuhan was doing. Of course, we spent that week, and he learned everything about McLuhan that he didn't know, you know. He really found out about McLuhan. So I really impressed him on what McLuhan was really about. So we had a great time. So we stayed in touch on the phone until till April 1980, where he invited Carol and I out to his place, and we went out to their mansion in Aspen, spent a week or so there. Then we went to L.A. to see Jonan Sloan and Dave Worster and other people, and Walter and I stayed in touch all through the 80s. And let's see, did I ever see him in the 80s? On the phone a lot. So we went and saw him in September, late August 1990. Jerry Fialka met us in Phoenix, Arizona, and we drove down to Walter's cabin. which was the original cabin he and Peggy Mellon went to in 68 when he left the East Village Other. And so they would use that cabin for all those years, 68 to 90. And now Walter was staying there. So during that week, we had a great time, and Jerry took a videotape of us sitting there, me talking to Walter. Now, although I remember now, in 1985, here's what happened in the 80s. So in 1982, we went out to visit him in Port Townsend, north of Seattle, on the bay there, you know, looking over towards Vancouver Island. And he and I, it was April 82, we drove down to Portland, Oregon to meet Paul Shockley, the other medium for Cosmic Awareness. And there were some other people there, and Dee Dee Farrell was there who distributed the D-cells. She did that later. So we had a very interesting conversation with Paul Shockley and this other guy. And then we drove back, and we almost died going down there because I was playing him Dr. Beter tapes, and Walter kept falling asleep and, you know, almost driving off the road. So we stopped that. But and then in 83, we went to Hawaii, but we passed through Port Townsend again and spent a few days with Walter. And we watched his girlfriend, maybe even wife, Margot, leave him and drive off to start. Oh, that's right. Oh, yeah, so in 1980... when we met Margot, Walter was with Margot. He had met her. She was the secretary of Gallery Magazine that he was writing for in the 80s, in the late 80s. I didn't know that. In the late 70s. So Margot had hurt her knee, and Carolyn did acupuncture on it. And then Margot was fascinated by that, so she learned how to do acupuncture. And so she, a few weeks later, did acupuncture on the guy that Donald Sutherland plays in JFK. What is his name? He wrote the book, The Secret Team. Fletcher Prodi. So Fletcher Prodi was an ex-CIA guy who had a lot of stuff to say, and he quit and wrote a book and exposed a lot of stuff. Margot did acupuncture on him in Amsterdam a few weeks after she learned a little bit of it from Carolyn. That was in April 1980. So then we see Walter in April 82. We go and see Paul Shockley. Then in 83 we see him, and we all said goodbye to Margot, who had now wanted to become a doctor. She'd been inspired by Carolyn, so she wanted to do something in medicine. So she said, I'm leaving you, Walter, and I'm going to go down to California and learn how to do some of this stuff. So we all watched her drive off. It was sort of on friendly terms, watched her drive off and leave Walter, thanks to Carolyn, what she had done to Margot 3 years before. Another divorce we inspired. And so that was Walter. And then in 85, we visited Walter in Palm Springs. By that time, he'd left Port Townsend and got a job in Palm Springs editing the high-level, high-class magazine. So now he was hanging out with the rich people as the editor of the local glossy, slick magazine. So that was fun. And then 87, 88, I don't think there was any involvement with Walter personally, though we were always on the phone. He was always up on what I was doing. I was always trying to explain McLuhan to him. He was always resisting the explanation, but still would quote it when he wanted to stun other people. He would use my what he got from me. And you can see it on a Ted Lohman interview. He's there talking about MKUltra, the whole stuff he always had to talk about and probably get sick of doing it. And so at the very end of the show, he says, well, that's nothing what I just told you. You gotta understand Marshall McLuhan. There's a guy named Bob Dobbs. That's who you should interview. And he went on about me and McLuhan and totally confused them all about the McLuhan level. I don't know, probably because he didn't explain it that well, but at least he made them aware of something they didn't know. So then in 1990, we went to Paradise, where he had his cabin, which is at the four corners of whatever, New Mexico, Arizona, Oklahoma, whatever meets down there. Do you know those four corners? Or the four points? Yeah. So Arizona is, New Paradise is there. And that recording, and so that's Walter, that he spent a lot of time with me when he assesses me in that. He says, Bob, there's only two people in the world who are going to understand you, and you haven't met them yet. There's only two people who can understand you, and you haven't met them yet. It was a great line. But also, it was very funny. I'm there trying to fucking teach him shit, and he's just being silly, sort of, right?
Yeah. Yes, yes.
He's playing with puppets. Like, and
he was a straight guy, and you're trying to teach him something funny.
Wait a minute. He's the comedian. No, he's the comedian.
He's the comedian.
And
you're
I'm the fall guy, and I'm trying to make him say funny jokes. And he won't. He will do silly jokes. I'm not impressed with his jokes. And so I had to take over and become the funny guy and make him the sidekick.
Oh, that was fun. That was really, really, really fun to listen to and watch.
And it shows you what a great guy he is. He's got a great sense of humor. He kept his childishness. You know, he kept his child heart, childlike heart kind of thing. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Personality.
Yeah. Well, that was actually the first time I've ever, you know, saw him and heard him talk. You know, just to actually see him. And it was like, it was really fun to see you guys engage. That was fun. That was really fun.
Yeah. Yeah, because you know he would brag about me to other people that he knew me, but whenever we got together, he would compete sort of with me. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I picked that up as well. You picked that up. That's a subtlety in that. That's sort of like when he wouldn't answer you or do what you were trying to get him to do. So that was like that little pool of competition between you. Yeah.
As a matter of fact, whenever, I think it pretty well happened, I don't know if it happened every time, but eventually we'd have an argument, and he'd get outraged with the way I am, or was, or what I fucking thought, and try to get me to come down to earth with the practical CIA MKUltra issues that he dealt with. And we had a big blowout before that recording. And actually, Carolyn witnessed it. I actually got through to him. I made him realize something about, what was it? It's something about the, you get a big insight. Like, he was into neurolinguistics and studying, I don't think he got into hypnosis yet, but, you know, he was about, you know, you get these big insights. And then I pointed out to him, well, how come people forget them within 6 months and they're fucked up again? And I said, it's because the electric environment is eroding away all your insights. So he actually got that point that there's something else eroding everything that we find valuable, even insights. They become meaningless because of the endless pattern recognition 24/7 that happens, and your mind melts, falls away. So he finally got it. So it was the first time he actually sort of stopped arguing. So he was sort of feeling nice towards me when that interview happened, you know, a day or two later. Or that dialogue was recorded. You wouldn't have believed it 2 days. He wasn't feeling happy towards me 2 days before. And he knew this would happen every time. He used to say, Bob, you show up, we interact for a week or so, and it takes me 3 weeks to recover, is what he used to say. Until eventually he could remember his old routine and go back to his old con game of Mr. Expose of the MKUltra. And he told me in 1980 when I first was with him that he regretted he wrote that book. He said, I should have written fiction. They wrecked my family. It wasn't worth it, what he got from the exposure of MKUltra.
Wow.
And that's long before James met him.
Yeah.
James Curtis, James Martinez.
Yes, I found it funny that I ran upon that, and it was like a week later, Ion exposed James's real name on payday.
Right. You mean a couple weeks ago?
Yeah, a couple weeks ago. And then also, then you were talking about it, James was on Randy Moggins and regurgitating some old shit from Boris Cashflow days about money or energy and all that stuff.
And fake media ecology. He can't even talk it very well. But yeah, that's what that was time. Like Ion, I think Ion said that right after he was on Randy Moggins,
and
he knew about that. And I think I listened to the show because they were promoting Bucky Fuller pills or something. But the which product they go on about, Carolyn been through that 10 years ago. You know what I mean? That crap.
Yeah.
You know, and she could explain what they couldn't explain, why it was temporarily effective, sort of. But then she'd tell you the problems you get from it. But so you heard Ion expose him.
But Ion had been exposing him for years. I just never had a, you know, vengeful spirit to say what Ion was saying. But you go back and listen to Paydays, occasionally he would go, yeah, James Curtis, he would say the name.
Oh, no, I never heard that. I never heard James Curtis, but he always made fun of James that James wasn't getting it. Subtlety.
Yeah. Right, and this time when he said the name Curtis, I said, look, people, that's what he's doing. So I exposed what he'd been exposing for a long time, but I didn't, out of politeness, never said anything. But now the gloves are off, so we tell everything about James. So then Walter in 91 he came to Toronto. And he and his new girlfriend stayed with us for a week or so, and then Peggy Mellon, who had a cottage, they had their Mellon family, they the rich people of the United States, England, New England seaboard, all have cottages up in a certain area of Ontario. The Carnegies and everybody used to go up there 100 years ago. So she was in that area. She's there every August. So they visit us, and we talked to her about Walter after Walter had been with us a few weeks before. And let's see, so that was Walter 91. Then we were living in New York City in 94, and he visited New York, so we saw him in 94. And then next time we saw him would have been 2005, many years later, 10 years later in Toronto, and that's when I met James. He had moved to... he had got busted. When he came back, he saw us in New York in 94. When he went back there, somebody had planted marijuana on his on the little log cabin property, and he got busted. So he was on probation for 3 or 4 years, couldn't leave Arizona, and he was pretty pissed off about that. And then when he could leave, he went to L.A. to, you know, sell MKUltra book, Operation Mind Control, to Oliver Stone, and he used James to start to make the connections. James knew some people. Then they end up living together, or, you know, staying together in some place in Santa Monica. And then in September 11th, I don't know if James had ever heard about this before, but on September 11th, they watched the destruction. Then Walter went off to his room and closed the door. And James wondered what was going on, and after 45 minutes, he opened the door and said, what's up, Walter? Walter seemed upset. And Walter says, fucking Bob and McLuhan, they're fucking geniuses. that's what he said. That was his reaction to 911, that he had to admit that Bob and McLuhan were geniuses. And James goes, what are you talking? He didn't know what he meant. You know, who are you talking about? So he said, Walter explained me for the next few hours or days and went on about me. And over the next few months told James he has to call me. And so in the spring of 2002, I got a call from a guy named James who said he was living with Walter. And that's how we started our dialogues. And that was interesting because he was telling me the effects of the cell phone in his social life in Hollywood. And that conversation we had in the spring of 2002 was the same conversation we had every week on the radio show. It was always about James's latest anecdote about what the cell phones were doing and me trying to explain to him why that was happening. You know.
Yes, I remember that, yes.
The five-body model. So it was always the same conversation. And I was always interested in what James had to say because he gave anecdotal stories about the effects of cell phone in the Hollywood world. And meanwhile, Walter got sick, had to go up to San Francisco for a year, had surgery. And he came back down to L.A. in February 2005, and that's when we did the glow, you know, the glow with Candy Zappa and all that stuff. I think we did that recording a few days before I went to L.A. And I must have been on the show or on the studio in there, but I don't remember Candy being on the show with me, so I must have been still in New York. But I did meet Candy the next week later when I went out there. But I met Walter, and you have that picture on the internet or someplace in a video of me talking, and beside me is Walter, and you can see James. We're at a desk, at a table, and that's the Fittings
yes.
Wake Society of L.A., of Venice, Jerry Fialkin's Fittings Wake Society, which I started with him. And so there's a little 34-minute movie video of us, and you see Walter talking to people, and I'm talking to people. That was after that meeting. And then a year later, 2006, Walter had a freak out, and he got pissed off at everybody, and he insulted James. So James called me up and said he's not going to talk to Walter, and he didn't talk to Walter for about a year into 2007 until he heard that Walter was dying. And meanwhile, we'd come to Hawaii here in November 2007. I spent 2 weeks here. Carolyn spent another three, four weeks here. And I went to New Zealand. And coming back on December 22nd and 23rd, like December 17th, 18th, James emails me to say Walter's dying. And then, a few weeks before that. Then on the 18th, I get the word that he died. And then I fly to L.A. on the 21st, 22nd. And you can see those YouTubes where we're in James in this other person's home with James and Scott Norris. And we're just sitting there talking about different things. You can see those YouTubes. That's when I reconnected with James, having seen him a bit in 2005. And then a few weeks later, when I went back to New York, he said, hey, why don't you come on my radio show? So that started on January 16, 2008, in the wake of Walter dying.
Hmm.
Then I went out to Hawaii, L.A. in May 2008 on the way to Hawaii, and that's when we had a private memorial with Walter, with his Russian friend, the Russian girl and her husband, and James and I went in the backyard. And James channeled Walter for about 5 hours, and we had a very interesting talk. And then James and I were driving home from that meeting, and all of a sudden Walter came through again, and Walter said, "Your chart's going to become way more complex." Like James is just saying these words. He's saying, Walter's saying that your chart's going to become way more complex. It's very simple right now, and in 100 years people will be making cartoons and paintings about you. That was a prediction by Bowert. And that would be less than a year before Ian showed up.
Mm.
And so if anybody's going to be making paintings and cartoons of me, it's because of Ian. So that happened. So that's Walter Bowert. Well, you want to go on to the next guy?
Yes.
I should say this, Bert. And you can go on, who was it? Ed Long interviewed us. We got interviewed. James and I got interviewed about Walter, and then we brought Ian through, and Ian talked about Walter, and this and that. You know, that's one of the first things on Ian and Bob. One of the first things we did using Ian you ever heard those? Those long interviews?
No, I've never heard that one. I've never heard that one with Ian and Walter Bowert. I'll have to listen to that. That's...
Yeah, well, there's one with James. Who interviewed us? Was it Project? No, it wasn't Project Camelot. It might have been Ed Long. Ed Long interviewed us for his site. Interviewed James sort of separately, then me separately, then the both of us together, and then we did Walter and Ian. So several, many recordings. They're probably on my timeline.
Yes, I'll look in your timeline.
Yeah. When James channeled, quote channeled, I don't know what it was he was doing, because James didn't think of himself as a channel. It turned out that James, when he smoked marijuana, this would happen. So I found out by May 2008, when we did our Walter Memorial, that through the years, Walter would they'd smoke up some dope or something in Santa Monica in their apartment. And many hours later, James would come to and see Walter writing down all this stuff, had notes. But James never figured it out, or he didn't know what was going on. And not until I got involved that we jogged James' memory, and he realized that he started channeling when he got stoned, and Walter never told him, and Walter would do whatever he could with James, you know, and take notes without James knowing. So that went on for years, and so when... after Walter died, through 2008, while we're doing the radio show, every now and then James would get a message from Walter and tell me, and that would be the spring of 2008. So by the time And he didn't tell me this till after Walter died. Well, there was no reason to know until Walter died. And then James would tell me he got a message. And then we did that in May 2008. We did that five-hour thing, but I was used to James picking up messages.
Hmm. Thanks for that, because I remember hearing earlier one time you said that James was channeling Walter, but now you give me the background. So it looks like Walter was doing an experiment with James when they used to smoke.
That's right. And let me see. There was something maybe before, okay, so that's 2008. Just before, right in the, or like before Ian showed up, or the day after Ian showed up, I talked to James and Walter came through, and he said a lot about what would happen to us. And that turned out to be true, you know, in relation to Ion. But that was before I knew, understand what was going to happen with Ion. He actually did pretty good stuff. And James, I talked to him later, and he didn't remember it at all, what was said. Yeah, Walter said some interesting things. So, but we never, once we got into full-blown cash flow, we never did that anymore. We had Ion. We didn't need to talk to Walter.
Yeah.
So I don't know what James does with that anymore. So
apparently nothing. Apparently James doing nothing if he got off the RNA drop. So I mean,
yeah,
and trying to promote some other product. But anyway, yeah, Bob, I've been quite fascinated in the last month when Carolyn said that she's amazed at the similarities of you and James Joyce. So that's always something that's always in the background for me when I'm reading and looking around. And then the next, I think a week after Carolyn mentioned that, I got to chapter 9 of Don Thiel's book, McLuhan Joyce and the Evolution of Cyberspace.
Right.
And there's, I'm wondering if you could expound on this, because I found it amazing that McLuhan used Joyce and referenced him. But then Don Thiel mentioned that, and he was amazed that McLuhan never mentioned to him that McLuhan expressed that he thought that Joyce's later works were very demonic.
Okay, so that's a complicated story. there's a letter by McLuhan to his friend Walter Ong in the 40s where he says, I realize that Ulysses and Finney's Wake are like one long black mass. They start with Buck Mulligan on the first page of Ulysses doing a fake quote from the mass, sort of like upside down black mass, and then Finnegan's Wake ends with a black mass. You could interpret it that way. So this concerned Marshall about what Joyce's motives were. Now, he was always taking Wyndham Lewis's side in the debate with James Joyce. So Thiel eventually wrote a book in 1971 called The Medium is a Rearview Mirror, and he writes this brilliant stuff at the end of the book about how McLuhan used Joyce in a distorted way on behalf of Wyndham Lewis. And it's a very, very sophisticated, you know, inside issue, but probably not important in general for studying mediacology. It's just a, you know, Don Thiel had his baptism through Marsh McLuhan. He was McLuhan's first PhD student, contributed a lot to McLuhan's early world. And so it was very personal and close to him what happened between him and Marshall. So, and he knew the Wyndham Lewis part of Marshall's personality. So Don is citing experience that nobody else really has. Unless you really, if you know Don and then he tells you this, then you can go read McLuhan's articles and you can see it. But it's a very, very deep, intimate view. And Marshall tried to suppress that book, The Medium is the Rearview Mirror. And they needed five college presidents from the East Coast of Canada to solve the issue. And eventually it turned out that Don wasn't over-quoting McLuhan, and he was McLuhan's complaint was thrown out. So he got the book published. But there was a lot of tension between McLuhan and Don, because Don knew too much. And McLuhan told him, when CBC asked Don to explain McLuhan for them in the late 50s, McLuhan heard about it and he told Don, don't tell them everything. We must keep the mystery going, blah, blah, blah. So there was that tension. Okay, so so what Don felt as he got more and more expert on James Joyce, and when the digital world started happening in the late 80s, early 90s, and he read a book by Stuart Brand called The MIT Lab, where the scientists said they used McLuhan. I don't know if they said James Joyce, but when you use McLuhan, you're using Joyce. And they used McLuhan's insights to help them think through making their Android meme technology. So when Don saw that, he went back and said, this is something McLuhan didn't write about. So he became famous in the 90s, pointing out how Finnegan's Wake anticipates digiculture, or the Android meme, or this internet world. And so he was updating McLuhan. McLuhan said that Finnegan's Wake is about television. But Don took it further and showed and proved, respectably, that the digiculture was embedded in Finney's Wake. Now, McLuhan did say that all future technologies are included in Finney's Wake. So that's a vast generalization, but he didn't show in particular how the computers were. Basically, Marshall died before that could be done. But Don did it, and it's really important. And Don thinks that McLuhan simplified Joyce too much. The media simplified McLuhan too much, and so the real value of James Joyce is lost. So Don says, let's forget about McLuhan right now. Let's go back to Finnegan's Wake and realize what McLuhan got from the Wake and what many other people got from Joyce, and realize that he was the guy who anticipated all this stuff. And that's the name of the book, The Joyce Era. It's called Beyond the Word, subtitled The Joyce Era in Culture, Technology, and Communication. So Don is on a mission to signify Finnegan's Wake that McLuhan started to do but got bogged down in his own stuff and became famous separate from James Joyce, and Don wanted to correct that. That's Don's mission, and that's the context for whatever he's saying that you're quoting.
Okay.
So Don said, now we get into this. Don said that Marshall was not schizophrenic, said he was schizoid, using a slang term. He wasn't going to say, that Marshall was ill, as it technically, termed schizophrenia. But he said Marshall never resolved his contradictions. So that even though Finnegan's Wake was a black mass, and that was a problem for Marshall as a Catholic, McLuhan had to use Joyce and all that stuff and praise him, especially in the 60s. The complexity of the 60s, the psychedelic 60s, would need a book like Finnegan's Wake as an end environment, not something by Wyndham Lewis, who didn't have such a psychedelic book like Finnegan's Wake. So he had to use that kind of book, Finnegan's Wake, to attract the students to think about what's happening to them around them. So Don said that McLuhan never resolved his Catholic self and his interested in the occult, interested in the arts and the pagan world. Now, I used to have discussions with Don about whether I agree with him or not, and that's a complex topic. But I was the only one who was aware of what Don was on about, and that's why Don mentions me at the beginning of his second book on McLuhan, The Virtual Marshall McLuhan. It was our dialogue. He had never met anybody who knew McLuhan as well as he did and actually had some new aspects to say that would challenge Don. So we had a good dialogue, and we talked a lot about whether McLuhan was schizoid or not, or why does he come across that way? Why does that bother Don,
Yeah, that relates to the next point, is that he, in that same chapter, he was sort of comparing the joke, like McLuhan's, stern jokester type, and then Joyce had a comedic range reference within, I think it was Ulysses and Finnegan's Wake, that Joyce's comedy was jokes were more richer, but then he was doing like the comparison.
Yeah, I can explain what it is. McLuhan said he was a Menippean satirist, and if you look up Menippean satire, it comes out of Diogenes, the philosophy of cynicism. And usually Wyndham Lewis and McLuhan as Menippeans are hard Puritan almost, very aggressive. But there's another kind of Menippean satire that's called Veronian satire. So in history, since Varro was the guy in the time of Jesus who discovered the Menippean satires written by Menippus, later, in thousands of years later, say Dryden, the British poet Dryden, he named the Menippean satire Varronian satire, V-A-R-R-O-N-I-A-N, after Varro. Well, the Varronian satire, you emphasize the carnivalesque, the celebrating, and the Rabelaisian, and the sexy stuff. McLuhan tended to not go for the sexy version of Menippean satire, but to go for the self-awareness, prick people's awareness, make them wake up, and you can be mean to them. So you're not celebrating the joy of life so much. And so Don said that Joyce was a Veronian Menippean satirist, and Lewis and McLuhan were cynical Menippean satirists.
Yes.
And Joyce was more fun-loving. So I would be in the Veronian category because I have Joyce in my quadrant in the tiny note chart, and the quality of my quadrant is ecstasy. So the pursuit of ecstasy is maybe not so much what McLuhan would do. McLuhan is even, in interviews, said he celebrated suffering. He explored suffering. So Lewis and McLuhan were the ant, and Joyce and Thiel and Dobbs were the grasshopper.
Yeah, that explains it, because I saw there's a YouTube of McLuhan when he was on a television show, and he had like a revolving chair, and his expressions on his face and what he was saying, you could see that he had a kick of the things he's saying. He knew that they were going to shock the people in the audience.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, that's a famous CBC interview, Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, at the height of his fame in 1967. And the whole country thought that they had to interview this guy. What is this guy doing? You know, this respectable professor at the big university who's sort of acting weird. They put him in a crossfire there. You know, put him in interrogation like Socrates, right?
Yeah, yes. And he was enjoying it. I mean, he enjoyed I think it's 10 minutes or 15 minutes, and you can see he was really enjoying himself the entire time. And he was, yeah. I think he was turning his chair and just looking, or like smirking when he was saying things and looking at the audience. That was really funny. And then you hear what he was saying was a lot of the slogans that I've heard over the last 3 or 4 months, which you've been playing, that he was like,
yeah,
you know, saying them out, and you could just feel the shock of the people, and he's just enjoying it.
That's right. Yeah, he, they say something like, what if we all, you know, took what you were saying to heart and actually started doing it? And he says, no, I'd never want that. I don't think anybody should take me seriously. Here they were, taking him seriously, giving a whole special one-man scenario on TV. They'd never done it for anybody. And he's saying, oh, well, this is not necessary. I'm not a serious person.
Yeah, no, that was really funny to see, to have the not only the ear, but to see the eye and the look in his expression,
yeah,
of his face. He had like almost like a Cheshire cat grin, you know, and he was just saying, knowing it was, they were going to eat it up and then confuse him.
That's right. He was going to confuse him. Like he's aggressive there. He was asked, what role do you, in a TV documentary, what's your role? He's the enemy. I'm the enemy. You know, he's the enemy of everybody, and this is, so he wanted to shake people up. Whereas if Joyce was there, Joyce would start singing, right? Playing songs and acting like an alcoholic, you know? What the heck is that noise? Let's see what that is. Coming through, Renee. What the hell are you doing, Renee? That was Renee's sound. So you still there, Bert?
Yes, I'm here.
So, yeah, and, you know, Lewis and McLuhan, they had an agenda. They were actually spiritual. They wanted to wake the people up, and they'd be tough in any way. They could, you know, and be glad.